Maybe invite everyone to squash up a bit, come closer to the front, because there are a lot of people who are congregating at the back. So maybe all the yogis in the front, please come closer to the Buddha. And all those in the middle, please come closer to the Sangha. And those at the back, please come closer to the middle way. So please come and find a nice seat somewhere inside. There is lots of spaces available somewhere.
Can we, Venerable Ajahn's permit? Venerable Sirs, and Bhante, Bhante. And brothers and sisters in the Dharma, good evening to all of you. We are very privileged and very grateful to Venerable Ajahn Brahmaso to come over to Penang. Venerable Ajahn Brahm has just finished a 9-day retreat in KL. And yet, by that, Venerable Ajahn Brahm has the compassion and kindness to still come over to Penang to teach us over a few days. And as you all know, Ajahn Brahm's energy is legendary. Ajahn Brahm has been bestowed the title of Chao Kun Pra Visuddhi Samvarathera.
That was close. Well done.
Sorry, it's a bit of a tongue twister. Chao Kun Pra Visuddhi Samvarathera, which was bestowed on Ajahn Brahm by the Cape Island earlier this year. And we're very pleased to see all of you tonight. Venerable Ajahn, the special one who will give the talk tonight. By the way, there's also one couple who just actually, the title is actually Love and Marriage in Buddhism. There's actually another friend, a brother and sister who had just got married, had a wedding reception on Friday and Saturday, and they are spending their honeymoon in this retreat. I didn't tamper beforehand on this. The title was just a coincidence, or was it something else? I don't know.
Okay, it's a very good thing that you've come on this retreat. So I'll fix you up before it gets too late. Because the title of today's talk is about love and marriage and Buddhism. And the reason why I give this talk, because very often you may hear talks on Buddhism about Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, this and that, which may be really interesting if you are a monk or a nun. But how many of you will ever become monks or nuns? Very few. And many of you will become married if you're not married already. And there's many stories about marriage which make me very, very concerned. For example, that one of the favorite similes for marriage, you know about the three rings of marriage, don't you? And what's the first ring of marriage? Is engagement ring. The second ring of marriage is wedding ring. And the third ring of marriage is suffer ring. Yeah. And there's other stories about marriage too. About the man who told me that when he was engaged, he used to hold the hand of his fiancée out of love. Now that he's married, he holds her hand out of self-defense. Man who told me that, he never knew what happiness was until he got married. And then it was too late. That is many stories about marriage and a lot of times about problems of marriage. And it's because of the problems of marriage that I'm giving this talk this evening, to try and solve those problems before they get too bad. Because you know what happens? If you have a problem in your marriage, who do you come under? Me. And because I like an easy life, because I like to have a peaceful existence, it's much better to solve problems of your marriage before they occur. By teaching you Dhamma to end one of the most important parts of suffering in life, your marriage. Because the Buddha did teach Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths is all about suffering and the end of suffering. So this is one example of the teaching of Buddha on the Four Noble Truths and how to end the suffering of marriage and have a happy time together. Most of you are get married, and so let's actually use the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha and the great disciples, so you can have a happy and rewarding time together. Now the first thing of marriage is your choice of partner. And many of you, when you are young, you go to extreme lengths to choose a partner you're going to live with in life. You go to dances and parties in the office and other places to find someone who is compatible. Some people even do research. My research on your partner. Check her out or check him out. What sort of income is he getting? What sort of friends has he got? And has he had girlfriends before? And what's he done to them? So once you've done market research, the next you do is like when you buy a car. Having researched the vehicle you want, then many people these days go test drive. To check if that's really the vehicle you like. So having gone to a great deal of trouble choosing your partner in life, why is it that so many people have difficulties once they've committed to buy? And it's such a great shame, having gone to all that care, why do we always make what we think are mistakes? Or do we really make mistakes? Because sometimes that when you get married, one of the first things we should know about marriage, that no matter what you think about your partner, they're not that perfect. They're just ordinary. Like this disciple in Singapore told me. She said that when she got married in Singapore, at the reception, her father took her new husband aside to give him some advice on how to have a happy marriage together. And he told his new son-in-law, his son, "You probably love my daughter very, very much." And the new husband said, "Oh, she's so nice. She's so cute and beautiful and gorgeous and nice and warm and cuddly and a good cook. She's so charming. Everything about her is so nice. Even the way she picks her nose is so sexy." And the father rolled his eyes and said, "Yes, that's what it's like when you fall in love. And that's what it's like in the honeymoon period. Everything about your partner is perfect, charming, and so lovable." "But," said the new father-in-law, "in a couple of years' time," some of you will be sooner, some later, "in a couple of years' time, you will start to see the faults and defects in my daughter." When you start to see her faults, always remember this. If she never had those faults to begin with, she would have married someone much better than you. So always remember that. When your husband turns out to be a sort of grumpy or not so nice, always remember, if he was that perfect, would he have married you, or would he got someone better? Which reminds me of another story, that once there's this young man from Penang. And he came from a good family, reasonably wealthy, had a good education. So he decided he's going to marry the most perfect girl in the whole of Malaysia. Why not? He was wealthy, came from a good family, had a good education. He was going to take his pick. So he went looking, and in Penang, he found this really, really beautiful girl. What these days we call a hot chick. But many young monks in my monastery are now teaching me modern language. He found this really hot chick. She was gorgeous. But he'd marry her. Even though she was so pretty, she was a terrible cook. And what's the point of marrying someone so beautiful if she can't even just make some noodles for you in the morning? So he gave her up and went further afield. Went down to Ipoh. And there in Ipoh, he found a really beautiful girl, even more beautiful than the first one here in Penang. And what's more, she was a great cook. She could open up her own restaurant. The food was that delicious. But he couldn't marry her either, because she was stupid. She hadn't finished school, and they couldn't have a conversation about things. She was so dumb. So he went further. And he finally found the perfect girl in KL. She was just ravishing. She could appear on the front cover of the glossy magazines. And her cooking, just even thinking about it, made his mouth water. And was she charming and intelligent? You know, she was a professor at the university in UJ. Oh, she was intelligent, a great cook, and such a good looker. She was absolutely perfect, the perfect woman. But he couldn't marry her either, because she was looking for a perfect man. Now, if you understand that story, we were always looking for the perfect girl. And basically don't exist. And she's looking for the perfect guy, and they don't exist either. So in your life, if you want to get married, your losses, he's good enough, she's pretty enough, you won't find anything better. Which is something really interesting, being a monk. Because people come and they tell me all their problems. And even though I'm a monk, I'm celibate about 35 years now, even before I was a monk. And they tell me all their problems, and I actually learn a lot about it simply by listening to people. And the key story which really stands out was this time a few years ago in monastery in Australia. And these two girls, they were sisters, and they came to me for counseling. And when I started listening to them, I talked to my elder sister first of all. She was a Thai girl who'd been living in Australia quite a long time. When she started talking, it was obviously her problem was with her Australian husband. She was having such a difficult time with him that she was seriously considering separation and divorce. She didn't like him. She wanted to get rid of him. She'd had it up to with him. So she wanted to get rid of her husband. Now, usually, as I will be talking a little bit later, usually I try and encourage people to work through problems, and I'll say why in a moment. Having tried to sort of give her some strategies to work through the problem in their relationship, then I talked to her younger sister. What's your problem? And she told her that she was single. She'd been going out with these boys, but in 1 month or 6 weeks it all fell apart and she had to start again. And she was getting old, and she was really concerned whether she'd ever find a husband. She really wanted a husband. And then an idea came to me. I said, look, your sister's got a husband he doesn't want. And you need one badly. Your sisters, swap. It made a lot of sense to me as a monk. But would they take that? No, they refused. But then, having made my joke, then I went deeper. And I turned to the first lady who had a husband she didn't want. And I said, madam, you have what we call in Buddhism, husband suffering. And I know this because many of the girls have talked to me about their husband. And basic, one thing you girls should all know, that the husbands, they're all the same. the Proton car here in Malaysia. They may look like they're made in Malaysia, but the engine comes from Japan. The same. So don't think that if you swap your husband and get a new model, that it's going to be any different than the old one. Husbands are all the same. So you have, madam, what we call husband stuffing. And just by the way, all men, all the wives are just the same as well. You may get sort of an Australian model, a Chinese model, or an American model, or a Thai model. But that's only the exterior upholstery. The engine and the electronics are all made in the same place. So, I said to her, you've got what we call husband suffering. It's always the same. But, I told her, if you get rid of your husband and get divorced, you'll just have what your sister has. Single woman's suffering. That's what it's like in life. When we've got a husband or a wife and we're having people, we think if we just get rid of her or him, all our troubles will be over. No, it's not. When you're married, you have married people suffering. And once you're single, you have single people suffering. Because you try to find another partner. So sometimes people think, oh, if you get married, you have suffering. If you're single, you have suffering. And they come to me and say, I want to be a monk or a nun. I said, listen, you have got what we call lay people suffering. And once you're in the Sangha and you renounce, you don't have that suffering anymore. You don't have to go to work on a Monday morning or worry about paying your bills. You won't have lay people suffering anymore. You will have monk suffering. Having to get up early in the morning and eat what you want to eat and give all this talking and counseling and give all these retreats, this is called monk suffering. So I told them, look, instead of trying to change what you have and think if I get rid of my wife or if I get rid of my husband or try again next time, then next time it will be better. Think again. The one you've got is probably the average standard model. It's not the Rolls Royce husband. It's not the Angelina Jolie wife. But it's good enough. Now, important to see it's good enough, because when you think the whole marriage is shot and the husband is no good or the wife is too selfish or whatever, it means you just want to try and make that marriage work. Now, if you really try and put some effort into it, it's amazing what you can achieve. This story told to me by a married counsellor, again in Singapore. That was her job. And she was a very, very clever girl. And one day, this client came to her, this middle-aged Singaporean girl, and again, she was fed up with her husband. He was quite a good provider, he had a good job, but he started coming back late from the office. And he gave all sorts of excuses why he was coming late. First she started to suspect, and then she was absolutely sure he had a child girl on the side. But she couldn't prove it. But nevertheless, she was absolutely sure. And anyway, he was coming back so late, he wasn't warm her or intimate or kind. He just, you know, treat her just like, almost like a maid. So she went to the counselor and said, look, I'm sure this is going, I want to get divorced. And the counselor was clever. She said, now listen, you know, that's probably what he wants, to get divorced, so he can be to follow his China girl or whatever. Do you really want him to be happy, said his counselor. And the client said, no, not what he's done to me. I want him to suffer like he made me suffer. I thought so, said counsel. Now listen to this plan. What you should do is like to start sort of sing up a bit. Maybe go to the beauty salon, get your hair fixed up, and start getting some nice clothes again. Maybe a bit of perfume or whatever. And wear that when he comes home at night. Because I know what men are like. Fell in love with you once. See if you can get him to like you again. Find out what he likes to eat. Cook that and be really nice and kind and charming to him. Because the plan is that once he starts to like you again, When he falls in love with you again, then divs it. And she's, yeah. Great plan. So that's what they did. She started dressing up, made them in the beauty parlor, now got her hair fixed up. It's amazing what you can do with chemo these days. And it's amazing, because she looked nicer and she was kinder, he started coming home earlier. And he started to be more friendly towards her. And counselor would see her every couple of weeks, how it's going. And she kept saying, it's really going according to plan. He's coming back earlier, he's being more kind to me, he's being more sort of intimate and romantic. It's going according to plan. Great, said the counselor, keep on going. In a short time, he'll fall in love with you. Yeah, and then we can do him. Yeah! And then after another couple of weeks, she missed her appointment. And the next appointment, too. But the counselor gave her a call at home. So you missed two or three appointments. What's going on? So it's going according to plan. What you mean? He's falling in love with you? Oh, yeah, I think he really has fallen in love with you. Falling in love with me, the client. Great, said the counselor. Now divorce him. Oh, no. It's so nice being with him again, and he's so kind to me. And of course, was the plan all along. That was a very clever counselor, because the counselor never wanted them to get this. All the counselor wanted to try and do was actually to see if they could fall in love again, which they did, and so they're happy together. Now, it tells you what can be done. The reason why we get angry at each other when we are husband and wife is simply because we get into a very bad attitude of what we see in our partner. For example, when I was in KL about 4 or 5 years ago, I was giving a lecture at one of the universities, and when it came to question time, one of the lecturers in that university stood up. She was very courageous to say this in public. She said, this morning, a couple of days ago, I caught my husband lying to me. I can't trust him. Should I get divorced? It's one of the reasons why people seek marriage counseling for monks like me. Because I don't charge, it's cheap. It's a bargain for money. Because this costs a fortune to go to professional marriage counselor, you know. So it's kind of, you're getting a lot of bargains coming this evening. You've got 3 questions afterwards. Bam. So she asked this 3 question. My husband lied to me. I can't trust him anymore. Should I get divorced? Now, how would you answer that? What I did was I said, please give more information. You know, how long you've been married and what you do at university. And she told me that they've been married about 3 years. And that she was a lecturer in mathematics at the university. Now, before I was a monk, I used to be a physicist, a theoretical physicist, so I knew about maths. And so I said to this lecturer, this professor in mathematics at the university, young, brilliant young lady, I said, let's do some probability theory. Let's do some statistics together. Now, you've been married for 3 years. That's roughly 1,000 days. Give or take 10 or 15 days here or there. Let's assume, and it's a reasonable assumption, that over those 1,000, those 3 years of marriage, on average, your husband has said, say, 20 things to you each year, on average, which could have been right, could have been wrong. So that makes 20,000 statements he made to you since you've been married. And now he's lied for the first time. According to probability theory, which you know better than me, I told her, it means the next time he opens his mouth, according to his past record, which is all you've got to judge on, it's a 20,000 to 1 chance he's telling the truth. What do you mean he can't be trusted? Now do you see the point here? This was just an example when somebody makes a mistake. That is all we see. And we can't see any redeeming qualities or any of the good things. When we see our partner has told a lie to us, we don't see any of the truthful statements they have made. All we see is the lie. And because of we just see the lie, that's when we think, I can't trust them, they're a bad partner, let's throw them away and get another one. It's called recycling. But that's not a good way to solve the problems of that particular type of event. So, the solution is to see the bigger picture. Don't just see all those times when your husband has come home late from work. Also see all the times your husband has come home on time for work. Don't just think of all those mean things your wife has said. Think of all the kind things your wife has said. And if you understand that, see the bigger picture. Even if sort of 364 days of the year your husband has come home late, if he comes home early, one, at least that's something to work on. Because once you see something which is worth encouraging, you have the means to save your marriage. And this is what I mean by this. Another true story, amazing story, which happened in Australia several years ago. This Australian woman had been coming to my meditation class every Friday evening for many years. But she'd sit in the back. I'd noticed her because she was a regular attendee. But she had never come to talk to any of the monks. One evening she came to talk to me. And she came to say thank you. Thank you for all the teachings and advice which she had heard. Because she's told me she had begun coming to the Buddhist temple 7 years previously. And she said the only reason she came to the Buddhist temple was not because she was interested in meditation, nor that she was interested in Buddhism. That's not why she came. The only reason she came was for an excuse to get out of the house, because she had an abusive husband who was not just verbally abusing her, but was hitting her. Now, it was a gross case of domestic abuse. And I'm sure that happened in Malaysia too. In the modern times, that is not acceptable. And even in a place like Australia, if a man hits his wife, he can go to jail. If they're married. It's very, very strong to try and stop such domestic violence in our communities. And there's no excuse for it. Because as a Buddha, there is another way. You don't have to hit her. I'll tell you afterwards how you can get your own way with your wife without her knowing. But anyway, they were, or rather he was hitting her, covered with bruises. Now she cared because 2 hours in the Buddhist temple were 2 hours when she wasn't getting hit. In those days there wasn't counseling available. But what she heard was better than counseling. She heard something which in Buddhism we call positive forgiveness. Now I mentioned the word positive before forgiveness. Because just forgiveness, as many of you will probably agree, is not good enough. You can't just forgive a man like that, who's just abusing and exploiting the weakness of his wife. There was something else which needed to be done. And this is a good example, because in life, too often, sometimes you think you're a Buddha. Forgive, forgive, forgive. But sometimes you think it doesn't work, just forgiving somebody else. It may be your partner in your company, who's sort of cheating. Forgive, forgive, forgive. It may be your wife who's cheating, your husband cheating you. Forgive, forgive, forgive. And many times people say, is that what you're supposed to do? But that means that I'm treated like a doormat. That means partner does whatever they want to do and I just have to sit and take it. Is that what forgiveness means? Here's another part which is essential about forgiveness, and it's the positive part. What it meant was this. She heard from our monks, from myself and the other there at the time, to forgive the abuses of her husband, but to do something more. That every time her husband acted in a kind and sensitive or reasonable way, then to praise him, to respond with kindness, to hug, to kiss him, or just to say just how much appreciated that small act of kindness, and forgive all the punches and all the beating. To focus instead on anything you see in your husband which is reasonable and kind. Now, not many people can do this, but she was one of these amazing women, one of my heroes, who I look up to and think, wow, that lady is like a saint. Because she told me it took her 7 years, 7 long years, but my goodness, it worked. Every time she was hit, she took it on the chin, walked away without complaint. But every time, every small act of kindness which her husband did, she reacted in such a positive way, with a kiss, with a hug, thank you so much. She overreacted. But the result of that, as any psychologist would know, was that the abuse, because it was forgiven, it wasn't focused on, it wasn't made a big thing, that got less and less, and the kindness got more and more. Whatever you respond to, whatever you reinforce, tends to grow. And she said, now her husband is the most gentle, kind, loving man any woman would want. And they came to the monastery with their two children. And you could see she had this amazing, wonderful relationship. She changed her husband from a monster to this gentle, sensitive, middle-aged man. And they had these two amazing kids. She did that. She made her happiness, her marriage, and at the same time, with great compassion, changed a bad man into something very wonderful. And when I see her, I just think, wow, she sort of shines. She's got this beautiful twinkle of happiness in her eyes. She made that happen. Maybe you can't go that far, but certainly, if you have a relationship, a marriage, don't go focusing on all the faults in your partner and making that such a big deal. Because if you do, you know what happens? You start speaking to each other in a bad way. As they say, in the first year of a marriage, the woman listens to the man because she loves him. In the second year of the marriage, the woman talks and the man listens. In the third year of marriage, they both talk and the neighbors listen. In other words, they're shouting at each other. Why does it get that point? And it is because we keep focusing and reinforcing the faults in each other. And those of you who've been married for a while, you know that happens. What do you ever talk about? The things you don't like in each other. So why can't we just put them aside? Because this is basic Buddhist psychology. And instead on focus on the things you respect, you care and love about each other. And if you did that, those things which will grow. So every time your husband does something you really appreciate, which you love and consider wonderful, reinforce that, even go over the top, give him kisses and hugs. Say, oh, such a nice, kind, wonderful thing. You're such an amazing husband. You know, to wash one dish. Oh, amazing. Whatever it is, over the top. Because everybody likes praise. You know that 12 months ago I was visiting United States and there's this one fellow who was making a fortune. He started up a company in the United States and quickly franchised it to train your pets not to poo or pee in the house. Because people like pets. They have these little puppies or kittens. And anyone who's a pet in an apartment or small house knows that pet can cause a lot of damage to your expensive furniture. Because you know, they're animals. And they will poo, they will excrete or urinate anywhere. So you have to potty train your pets. And this guy was doing it for them. It was a potty trap business for your pets. And it was a very simple technique. This man and then his other co-workers, the ones he trained, would go and be with a little puppy and take it outside, you know, into a park or a little tree or somewhere where it poo or pee without any problem. And it would wait there, and when that little puppy did its business in the tree, then this man would jump up and down for joy, punch the air, do somersaults, sing a happy song, jump up and down with joy, and the little doggy would see that. And the little doggy, you know, it's an animal, would see that whatever it did made the human being so happy, they would only poo outside from that time on. It was positive reinforcement. Now, if that works with little doggies, surely that can work with your husband. I'm not saying your husband is a little doggy. But if you're kind to him, he does wag his tail. And you can do that with your wives. It's called positive reinforcement. So whatever you want to see grow in your partner, reinforce. However, I did hear later on there was a downside in that business, because there was a few of the animals who were trained that way, who were in the house or apartment while the husband was watching the football on TV. And when his team scored a goal, he would punch, jump up and down, and the dog would poo on the carpet. But apart from that, you can soon force that out. Apart from that, it worked perfectly. Now, this is an obvious thing, but it's a very simple thing, and that can save your marriage. No negative reinforcing, which is what we usually do, but a positive reinforcing. With that positive reinforcing of the good qualities of your partner, it's amazing what can happen. Positive reinforcing is actually how you can change many people. I know people say, oh, you can't change partners in marriage. You can't change your husband. You can't change your wife. What you marry, what you're stuck with for life. But that is not true. People do change, and they want to change. All they need to know is how to change. And this is how people do change. Positive reinforcing. But I did say in passing, sometimes that, you know, that there's always one partner in a marriage who's a dominant one. I call this the Mahayana-Hinayana marriage. This comes from Buddhism. You may know that there's supposed to be two types of Buddhism. The Hinayana Buddhism, where you're just concerned about your own enlightenment. You just want to become sort of peaceful and enlightened, and you don't care about other people. And the other type is where you give up your enlightenment. You don't care about yourself, but you give yourself, you sacrifice yourself to all others. Now, of course, that doesn't actually relate to life, because I'm supposed to be a Hinayana monk. How hard I work for other people. Because actually, even, for example, the abbots, the Buddhist Federation in Singapore, the abbot of Porkaksi Kongmeng Sanstri, Venerable Kuang Sheng, he's a good friend of mine. I mean a good friend of mine, because he was deputy abbot there for many years. When he got promoted to being the abbot of the biggest monastery in Singapore, guess who he invited to give the speech? He invited to go up and give the speech. That is elevation to being an abbot. And I was very touched with that, by that. And I said, you know, in my speech, sort of, you know, I'm a sort of the small vehicle. But in places like Singapore, small vehicles have many advantages. You can find car parking spaces and you can get round traffic. So they like that one. But it's not true, because he calls me a Theravada monk with a Mahayana mind, because I work hard helping other people. But nevertheless, it's a way of looking at a marriage. Because usually in a marriage, one partner is Hinayana. They're just caring for themselves, they look after themselves, and they just want. And the other part is a Mahayana partner, who give. Those of you in a marriage know what I'm talking about. And usually, and I'm saying as a monk, as a male, it's usually the Hinayana is the male, and the Mahayana is the wife. It's true, isn't it? Both are wrong. It's a dysfunctional marriage when you Hinayana, the other one is Mahayana. If you're Hinayana, you're just thinking of yourself, you're not really contributing to the marriage, you're trying to get what you need, your requirements, your desires, you've got your career, you just want your wife to sort of support your career and get on. You know, you want sex when you want it and you know about her and what you want is important and your life is just important. A life like that is selfish. It doesn't actually grow in the love which needs to be created. A marriage really strong. Nor is the Mahayana ideal right. Just give, give, give to your partner. Sacrifice, sacrifice, sacrifice. There comes a time when you've had enough. You're dry, you're burnt out, you're frustrated. What's the point? And you just give up then. Both are wrong. Which is why that when I do marriage blessings, I tell the happy young couple, because this is one time when they really listen. They're all soft. And they listen to me with big eyes and open mouths. It's the two times when people really listen to a sermon. Once you get married, the other's at funerals. They always listen to what I say at a funeral. So there they are listening. And I said to them, from now on you're married. You should never think of yourself. And they all, yes, yes, they understand. And then I say, from now on, you should never have your partner. What? What's he talking about? That's what they think. From now on, he thinks, I'm just going to think about her. And she thinks, from now on, I'm just going to think about him. And I say, that's wrong. And they get really confused. Which is the whole point of talk teaching. Get people confused, and then they're really listening. And I said, you should not be a Mahayana, nor a Hinayana in marriage. From now on, you should never think of your partner, nor think of yourself. From now on, you should think about us. Us, stupid. Not you, me, but us. You're in this together now. So us is actually the space between the two of you. When you're looking at your partner, don't look into her eyes, into his eyes, nor just feel your own heart. Look for what's going on between the two of you. That's what we call relationship. That's where the action is. That's actually where you understand where a marriage works and where a marriage fails. It's not his fault or my fault. It's always our fault. What we're putting between us. Now, for you yogis on a retreat, that's exactly how you get success in meditation. I'm just going to tangent here because this is part of a retreat. It does not matter what you're experiencing in your meditation. It does not matter how skilled or unskilled you are, whether you're man, woman, monk, layperson or whatever. What's really important in meditation is not what you're experiencing, but what's between you, the observer, and what you're experiencing, the observed. If you put peace, loving kindness, free gentleness in that space between you and what you're observing, you'll find your meditation takes off. If you're watching the breath, if you're watching the like this, putting force and will between you and the breath, you're going to get nowhere. If you put fear between you and that breath, or if you put goal or anger between you and the breath, or pride between you and the breath. Me, I can watch my breath. If you put the wrong things between you and what you observe, the meditation goes haywire. But if you put peace, kindness, gentleness between you, who you are, and what you're experiencing, your meditation goes very deep, usually very quickly. So if you're restless, if you're tired, if you're dull, it's the relation between that sloth and torpor which is a problem. Not being slothful or torpor. If you've got a restless mind, it's not being restless which is the problem, but your relationship with the restlessness, how you're dealing with it, what's between you and that restlessness. If you put kindness, gentleness, peace there, you know, like a Buddha would do, then the whole thing starts to develop into a very deep and very insightful meditation. That's exactly what you do in a relationship with a partner. It doesn't matter who your wife is,
or what your husband is doing. It's how you react to that. What's in between you? That's where the end of a marriage is. And when I talk like that, people understand at last why their marriages go wrong and how they can be healed. When they look in the right place, the relationship, how you're talking with each other, looking at each other, reacting to each other, in between, that's where you should look. And make sure there's peace, kindness, gentleness there. And if that's what you put between your partner, your relationship is going to grow, blossom, and give you incredible peace and happiness in life. Because if you're not going to become a monk or a nun, then life gets very lonely just being by yourself. People do need partners if they're going to live as lay people in this world. And one of the greatest things is actually to see these parents, you know, happy people who are at peace with each other, who've gone through the arguments and come out the other side, not defeated by those differences of opinion, but enriched and able to live together such peace and harmony, and with true love between them. What a great example that is to our children. With my mother and father, they used to argue. But one of the wonderful things I remember from my childhood, there they would argue, and my father would storm off, not wanting to speak to his wife, my mum. But then after about 10 or 15 minutes, or half an hour at the most, he'd come with his head bowed, give her a hug, and have a kiss. They'd make up. The wonderful thing I saw was they'd always make up in front of their children, myself and my brother. So what I learned from that experience was it's okay to argue. You're a human being. You have differences of opinion. Because you have differences of opinion, you will argue, you will see things from a different angle. But the most important thing was to put those things aside and remember what truly is important, your love together. And when I saw my parents making up like that, I realized, yeah, it's okay to argue. There's something bigger than being right. And to understand, there is one of the favorite stories about marriage coming from my wonderful teacher, Ajahn Chah. Many of you have heard this before, but I can't resist saying it again. It's a story of chicken and the duck. Now remember this, because of all the stories, this is one which saves your marriage. There were this happy couple. This husband and wife had only recently been married, just like the poor who are on this retreat. And after the retreat was finished, they decided to go for a walk in the botanical gardens. And as they were going for a walk in the gardens, they heard this sound. Quack, quack. Quack, quack. And the wife, oh darling, listen to that. That's a chicken. And he said, pardon, darling? That's a chicken which just went quack, quack. And he said, darling, now I love you, but no, chickens don't go quack, quack. They go cock-a-doodle-doo. That went quack, quack. That was a chicken. And she said, no, no, I'm sure that was a chicken. He said, yeah, it can't have been. That was duck. And it went quack, quack again. Quack, quack. See, duck. She said, no, I'm sure that's a chicken. He said, no, it can't be. It's a duck. She said, no, it's a chicken. He said, it's a duck. She said, it's a chicken. He said, it's a duck.
That's the thing I got around, didn't I? Anyway, someone said it was a chicken. Someone said it's a, who cares? But anyway, in this time, the husband had an insight. He said, I'm sorry, darling, I think you're right. It is a chicken. And she looked at him, tears coming down her cheek. She squeezed his hand and said to you, darling. And the chicken went quack, quack again. And they continued their walk at peace in love, without having any problems about getting a lawyer and and figure out how they can actually share the assets. In that story, and I do change the gender around anyone who was at my retreat in Canada, where I told that story last week. And that time it was a man who said it was a chicken. This time it was a woman who said it was a chicken. I have to change it around, otherwise I get big trouble with people. Why is it always a woman who has to win? Or why is it always a man, sometimes they say. But anyway, this time, the woman said it was a chicken. The man said, oh, you're right, darling, it is a chicken, when it went quack again. Now, in that particular version, the husband was the smart guy. He was Buddhist. He was a wise person. He was a passionate bodhisattva. You know why? For two reasons. First, who cares whether it's a chicken or a duck? It's important. So why spoil your evening and get a divorce over a blooming chicken or a duck? But that's what happens in a marriage. Not just in a marriage, but even friendships. We have these huge arguments over insignificant things. Number one, in that version of the story, the husband was wise because who cares whether it's a chicken or a duck? What's more important is their love together. That's why my father would give in and they would stop arguing and make, because they realized that being right was not important. Being in love was. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we all remembered that? So our politicians, our Mr. Bushes and Mr. Blairs and Mr. Olds and all these other people who always think, I'm right and you guys are wrong, would realize that there's something more important than being right. Peace and harmony. Love. So, first thing, that husband was smart because he realized it didn't matter whether it's a chicken or a duck. Just give in, make my wife happy. And number two, he was also doubly wise, because sometimes we are so sure we are right, and it turns out later we're wrong. That could have been a chicken. Really could have been a chicken, a genetically modified chicken. Made to sound up. It's amazing what they could do now with messing around with your genes. So there we go. The girl could have been right all along. A genetically modified chicken going quack instead of cock-a-doodle-doo. Now the moral of that story is that times that we argue and we create this terrible fear of marriage because we think we're right and we don't know what's really important. So if you remember that story, especially the two of you who got married, that story above all will save marriages. I always tell it when I do marriage blessings. Once at a food fair, a fun fair, which we had, funds for our monastery, a woman came up to me and said, you remember you performed our marriage blessing about 6 months ago. She said, you wanted to tell me this story. The reason why she was been giving up her weekend to help raise funds was because I saved her marriage. She said, after getting married, now after a couple of weeks, they started having arguments. Well, that wasn't really an argument because she would get upset and he'd just stand there. You know what men are like? Just stand there. And she talked to him. Actually, this was actually found out, this is true, found out in a large amount of research done in the United States. Women talk three times as much as men. It's true. For every three words a woman says, a man only says one word. It's been proved true. So you're in big trouble, aren't you, you girls? But it isn't what you speak, it's how you speak is more important. And she said that she would argue with her husband, he'd just stand there. And that got just so frustrating, so much so, that after about 5 months, she confronted him. She said, look, every time there's an issue in our marriage, you just stand there. You don't contribute. Now, don't you care about our marriage and our relationship? Why don't you get involved and you know what you think? And he stood there once again, but this time he spoke, but only two words. What he said was, chickens, ducks. And she remembered the story I told. And she realized that why her husband was not going to argue with his wife. Because of the chicken and duck story. Why argue over these small things? What was more important? They loved each other. So they hugged and kissed. And never argued again, she told me. And they had this wonderful relationship together. Now do you understand about the Dhamma and how it brings married people together? And when married people actually live in harmony together. The children learn from their parents by example how to live in some harmony, and then maybe they may go out into the world and have harmony and peace in the office without too much stabbing, and then they may have harmony and peace in the government without any sort of politicking, and harmony and peace in the world so there's no wars, simply because they start family to learn how to live together without arguing. What a wonderful world that would be. The marriage, family, is where we start from. All kids, at least most kids, start in a family. Now they learn about arguments, but that's also where they learn peacemaking. So isn't it wonderful if we can turn our families, our marriages, into great examples so our children can learn how to live, love, respect, and get on with each other. But I did actually say, I was going to actually tell you, get your own way with your husband or your wife. Without arguing with them, because there is always a dominant partner, but the other one can outsmart them. This is how to outsmart your partner. And get your own way without them ever finding it. Because when I first went to Australia, there was another monk who was my senior. He was the abbot and I was number two. And he was a very dominant personality. But I was smart. And so this actually happened. Many of you may also know that because I had to, because we were very poor when we first went to Australia, I had to learn how to build with my own hands. Many of the buildings in my monastery, I actually built myself. So, one day, I was walking with him in the grounds. We needed some more huts for the monks. So I pointed out a possible site, and I said, that would be a good site for a new hut. And he looked at that and turned around to me, that's a stupid idea. That's completely ridiculous. That's a terrible site for a hut. Now, if that was your partner, what would you do? If you were dumb, you would stand up for yourself and argue. Don't go that path. Use psychology instead. Be sneaky. So I was sneaky. I said, oh, okay, never mind. I dropped it immediately. I'd wait for usually 2 weeks. And then when we were walking together again in that area, I'd say again, you know, it'd be a wonderful site for a hut for a monk over there. And he'd say, no, that's a stupid site. Don't be ridiculous. We're not going to build anything there. But I would drop it again. What I knew from my understanding of meditation and the mind, once a person says something, you may reject it as a stupid, ridiculous idea, but it's already too late, it's got into your subconscious. And all I needed to do was to reinforce it, maybe after 2 weeks, at most 3 times, that's all I needed. Remind him again after 2 weeks. He'd have forgotten about it. I'd say, oh, it'd be great if we put a hut over there. Say, oh, stupid idea. But then a few weeks later, I'd be walking with him, and he'd, out of nowhere, he'd say, you know, that would be a nice sight for a hut on that hill there. Because it had been in his subconscious and had been working through the system. And if it is a good idea, and of course all my ideas are good ideas, like all your ideas are good ideas, if it really is a good idea, then it would actually come to the surface, he will see it for himself, and he will think, and this is the most important part, he will think it's his idea. But you put it in there. But you don't tell him that. Because he has to be the boss. So after he said, we should put a hut on the hill, I'd say, wow, what a brilliant idea of yours. And I knew where it came from. So that's actually how psychology works. You put these ideas into people, but if you argue, they know what's going on.
because it becomes a too important issue for it, and they remember it. You've got to choose your time. Just when they're nice and peaceful, they're thinking about something else, you slip it in there. And they say, "Oh, stupid idea." Okay, forget it. Reinforce it a couple of times, and you'll be amazed how well that works. You can get whatever you want out of your partner that way, as long as it's a reasonable good idea. So that's a way you can do these things without getting into arguments and problems. But when there is a problem, sometimes we do need to talk about the problems of marriage. But what happens, we always choose the wrong time and place. This is another problem. If there is a sensitive issue, don't confront your partner when they come home from work tired, or when your wife is going through one of those periods once a month where you've got to really tread gently, or when some difficulty has happened. Choose your battlefields. Every general knows that. And the best battlefield for actually talking to someone is the restaurant late at night, or some other romantic place. If you want to talk to your wife about something, take her out to her favorite restaurant. Dress up, take her out, doesn't matter how much it costs. And when you come, it's much cheaper than a lawyer anyway, restaurants. Once you come to the final course, she's so soft and malleable, like putty. You can ask her anything, and she'll say yes. It works. I told my monks that, because sometimes, you know, I get very tired, and they've got to ask, you know, can I go over to see my mother in England or something? Can I go here? Can I go to India on pilgrimage? And they know now, if I come back, say, from Malaysia, really tired, that's the last time to ask. They usually wait for the opportunity. They look at me and say, "I'm in a good mood. I just had a nice cup of tea, or something nice has happened." And when they see I'm in a good mood, they snap up the opportunity. Because when you're in a good mood, you always say yes. So please use psychology in a relationship and a marriage. Don't be a dummy and just spout out what you think you need to say whenever you need to say it. It's all about us. Not about him, not about me, but about us. When you know how to do this, you'll have a wonderful marriage. You'll be smart, you'll be developing wisdom, compassion, the skills, which aren't just for a marriage, but are for life, for your kids, even for your committees. There are too many Buddhist committees sometimes, which are committees before they're Buddhist. They argue with each other. And that's very bad for if you're a Buddhist to start arguing. So you should learn these amazing ways of having compassion and kindness and working together, just like husband and wife, to have love with each other. When you have love, you do have that peace, and you do have prosperity, and you work together, which is what the Dhamma is all about. So when you understand that, you can understand how you can have a happy marriage. When you have a happy marriage, then I can have a peaceful time and I can get more rest. You won't be knocking on my door, "Ajahn Brahm, can you please come and save my marriage? Ajahn Brahm, my kids are going crazy. Ajahn Brahm." So this talk this evening has been completely out of selfishness. So I could have an easy laugh. Thank you very much. Okay, are there any questions from the floor about love and marriage? I will just answer some on the pieces of paper over here. Is there any other sort of pieces of paper around where there's questions? Because if there is, then I can bring them up and I'll try and answer them. But first of all, these are actually general questions as well. On these three talks I'm giving here tonight, tomorrow night, and night afterwards, after the main talk, for the next hour or so, I'll answer questions on just about anything.
And this first question is, if all beings are reincarnated, how do you explain the increasing population? Where are the new beings being reincarnated from? The numbers don't match. And it's true, there's more people alive today than there have ever been. So where can all these new beings come from? Have you ever noticed that there are some people, some young people are really badly behaved? Some people actually act like animals these days. So where do you think they've come from? You know, because of all the pesticides now, there aren't as many cockroaches as there used to be. So some of them have got reborn as humans. Maybe not cockroaches, but animals anyway. So because the number of animals has actually gone down, as many human beings were animals in their past life. Here's a nice story for you, a true story, from one of the monasteries in Thailand. It is the Thai tradition that if you've got any unwanted animals, like pets which you can't care for, you usually dump them in a monastery, which is why you see these monasteries in Thailand with hundreds of cats and hundreds of dogs just barking at each other, and it's a real mess. Don't do that. But people do that because they think the monks and nuns are so kind and compassionate they will look after them, which they do, but it's a big mess. So don't do that. But one day, this layperson bought a monkey from the market. It was being very badly mistreated. Now, it's obviously it was caught when it was very young, put in a cage, and the cage was just really small, and the people weren't kind at all to these animals. So they brought it to the monastery, and the abbot accepted this monkey just out of compassion for it. This poor monkey had been sort of beaten and mistreated all his life. So they brought it to the monastery, and they led it out, and they looked after it and cared for it. And of course, if you care for the animals really look after and care for you. And soon the animal became part of the monastery. It was a forest monastery too. And every time there was tea time, because in those monasteries the monks would have tea maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And the monkey would always be in the dyeing shed with the other monks. And he would also have a cup of tea too, which he would hold in his paws and drink, just like the monks. It was really sweet and cute. But this monkey was very protective of the abbot, because the abbot had literally saved his life. And so when all these very well-dressed people came from Bangkok to visit this monastery, sometimes some of the people were cheeky. And when this is a very intelligent monkey, if it saw anybody being cheeky to the abbot, this is what he would do. He'd go to the first person and just sit in the lap so they could pet this lovely monkey. And it's just so nice, just stroking the monkey and tickling the monkey. And then the monkey would go to the next person. And they would stroke it and tickle it. And it was just so nice, holding a nice, friendly sort of pet monkey. It was so cuddly. But when it got to the person, usually the woman who was cheeky, he would go on the lap and bite her to show, do not be cheeky with my master, this monk. And unfortunately, it bit so many women from Bangkok. You know, not sort of badly, but just to make it sure that they should, you know, be more respectful to these very senior monks. Now the abbot thought, the monkey shouldn't do this. Perhaps we should take it back to a nature reserve. So the abbot told his number two monk, get a car, we'll take it to this animal reserve, which was in the middle of a big lake, this big island surrounded by water, which the government had reserved for nature, for wild animals, to live and be protected. So the second monk took this little monkey, he was very upset, but very docile, and got the boat, rowed over to the island, and let the poor monkey go. But the monkey never wanted to go. It just stood on the shore, forlorn and sad, as the monks rowed away. Because the monkey didn't want to go. He'd been naughty, he'd been a bad monkey. He knew he'd been bad, and now he'd been put on the island. But there's many other monkeys on that island, so, you know, he should be okay. But a few days later, the abbot, who was a great meditator, you know, had psychic powers, in his meditation he saw a vision. This monkey was not having a good time. He wasn't used to looking after himself, so he's really hungry, alone. Because you have to learn all the skills of foraging and looking after yourself when you're very young as an animal. If you don't learn them when you're young, you know, you can never learn them. So the abbot saw he was having a difficult time, so he told the second monk, go and take the car, get a boat, and get the monkey back. So he got the car, got the boat. This was a huge island, thousands of acres of nature reserve. He thought, how am I ever going to find that monkey? So he just called out his name, shouted it out. Within a minute he heard something swinging through the trees. And it was a monkey, and he leapt from the tree right into the monk's arms. He was just so happy he was with his friend again. So the monkey was just so overjoyed to be taken home. But on the boat, on the lake, the monkey bit the second monk, because, just to say, he wasn't very happy being left for so long. And so they brought the monkey back, and he stayed in the monastery until the day he died. And the way this monkey died was, again, he was so protective of the monastery. If there was any noisy cars being driven outside, he would chase the cars away. But one day he chased the truck, and the truck ran him over and killed him. And that was the end of the... Well, it wasn't actually the end of the monkey, because the abbot was sitting in meditation at the time and saw what happened. The stream of consciousness of this monkey left the body and went floating into the village. Now, because the monks go on arms round every day to the village, they know all the villagers. It's like being a family member. And he saw the monkey go into the womb of a pregnant girl. He saw it go in. And he told some of the monks what had happened to the monkey. And a few months later, when the woman gave birth, the baby boy, who was a human being, but it was very hairy for a young baby boy. It was a monkey. Had got a rebirth as a human being. And unfortunately, that abbot told too many people. So that poor young boy, when he goes to school, he's going to really have a lot of teasing from his friends. Hey, monkey, monkey, you were a monkey in your previous life, you're a monkey now. He was a monkey in his past life, being reborn as a human being. So that's what happens. People get reborn, even from the animal realm, into this realm. Any comments about that? Hands up if there are any monkeys here from the previous life. If any of your teenage kids like sleeping a lot, perhaps they were dogs or cats in the past. Because they like curling up sleeping. Anyway, in addition to the question I asked you this afternoon, when my body... Okay, this is somebody asked a question this morning about meditation. I get some strange experiences in meditation. And this lady had an experience of her body changing shape and her body turning into a triangle. At least that's what it seemed to be. In addition to the other questions I asked you this afternoon, when my body turned into a triangle and my legs lengthened with heads rocking vigorously, instead of feeling the calmness, I developed fear and searched frantically to come out, but very difficulty to do so. Why and so how to overcome the fear? Now this is just some of the weird things which can happen to you when you meditate, but you don't need to be afraid because nothing ever goes wrong. It's like having a free movie go in your head. It's very interesting and fascinating, but all it is I call it your perception being freed. So it can do weird and strange things. For example, the first time, well, one of the first times this happened to me was I was in, it said Wat Nanachat many years ago, and I was passing what was then the washing area, and I looked on the washing line and there was a black towel. And I stopped and looked at that towel and it was jet black. And I thought, they don't have black towels. Pink, green, yellow, white is the most common, or blue. But have you ever gone into a shop and seen anyone sell a black towel? And I looked at it for about 3 minutes, and this is weird. I don't know anyone with a black towel. I never knew that black towels existed. And as I was looking, perfectly alert, it was the middle of the day, maybe 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, then the towel turned back to white again. It was really weird. You saw something over many minutes and then changed color. This is just what happens when your mind starts to go very strong. What is black, white anyway, but just these labels which one learned at school, in culture, which have been reinforced from the time you were small until today. What happens in meditation, all those constraints get taken away and your perception can see things in a completely different way. There's nothing to be afraid of. You don't go crazy because it only lasts a little while when you're in the deep stillness. When you come out again afterwards, black towels, white towels, they come back to their normal state of mind. But those of you who are meditating, there does come time, it's amazingly common, where you're sitting there and you think you're rocking or your body is expanding, your head is becoming a balloon, you're going to float up into the sky and hit your head on the ceiling. But I guarantee, absolutely, 100%, you are being absolutely still, you're not moving, you're completely as you were when you started, nothing has changed, it's just the way we look at things. It's weird, but it's just perception playing around. And many teachers say, just reject that straight away. But for you yogis who sometimes have to sit here and meditate all day, it's a wonderful little vacation for you. At last, something interesting, and you can see all these weird and amazing things which are happening in your body. So go for it. Weird stuff is interesting. It's having your own special effects, even better than Mr. Spielberg can ever concoct. And afterwards, it all just fades away. So, the only thing which is a bad part of it, if you get afraid, and we just get tense, that's all. So you've got nothing to be afraid of. I've been teaching meditation, I worked out today about 25 years, and I haven't yet to have a casualty. No one has died on my retreat, no one has got crazy, but many people have got very peaceful and lots of deep insights. So, you are okay, you are safe. So if those things happen, enjoy it, get into it, and tell me about it afterwards. Maybe I can write a book one day of weird experiences in meditation, be a bestseller. Because people don't like Dharma, they like weird experiences. Ghost stories, Deva stories, weird experiences, yeah, they'll read those. How to reduce greed, hatred and delusion in our daily life, e.g. meeting with the difficult people in our daily job. In your daily job. On 2 days' time, I'm going to be talking about how to be a successful Buddhist business person, or something like that. So this is how you can be a successful business person and be a Buddhist at the same time. In fact, Buddhist people are, if you really know your Buddhism and your Dhamma and your meditation, you can have the competitive edge in Penang. You can outperform your rivals. Your company can go up the stock market list of top 50 companies because you have the Dhamma behind you. And I'll talk about this in a couple of days' time. This is no joke either. It does actually happen. But reduce greed, hate and delusion. It doesn't mean you don't have any desires because you've got to feed your family, you want to do well in life, but it's actually keeping it in the middle way so you don't go over the top and create more problems than it's worth. And hatred is a very bad strategy because when you get hatred, you get angry at somebody else, it never works. You just make the problem worse. But sometimes it's hard to stop getting angry. And this is another story which I love telling, which also fits in to married life. This is the story about the man who went to buy the eggs from the market. A long time ago, there was a man who had the afternoon off work. He was at home just pottering around while his wife was making the dinner. And his wife called her husband over and said, "Darling, I'm short of eggs. I need some eggs. Would you mind going to the market and buying me some eggs?" "Sure, darling," said the husband. "I'm not doing anything, but you'll have to show me what to do. I've never been to that market before." So she gave him the basket, gave him some money and directions, and off he went happily to the market to buy some eggs. When he got to the market, this young man, must have been about 18, came right up to him and said, "Have you been wearing dog shit for aftershave? You are so ugly, you look like a camel. The back end of a camel, that is. You stink and you look like the most stupid man." And he said much, much worse things than those, but I'm trying my best and there's a certain limit which even I can't go past when it comes to the way people insult each other. And this young man was really insulting this husband. And the husband got very angry and upset for two reasons. First of all, he never knew that young man. Who is he anyway? I don't know him. I've never done anything to him. And secondly, it was in public, in front of all the people shopping in the market. And he told this young man, "Look, leave me alone. I don't know you. What are you doing this to me for?" But that young man got even worse. He said some terrible things about this husband. And everybody heard it. And that was enough. The husband got so upset, he turned around and went home. When he got in the door, his wife said, "You're back early, darling." "There! Did you get the eggs?" "No! And don't ever send me to that stupid market ever again." He was really upset and angry. As you can imagine, you would be if you get scolded in public like that and you're completely innocent. But the wife was very clever. As many of you know, when your husband is that angry, you know just how to calm him down. Speak softly and kindly. Because only when he calms down can you get any sense out of him. And when he calmed down, then she asked, "What happened?" And he told the story of this young man coming up and abusing him and scolding him and defaming him and saying all these terrible things. And the wife said, "Oh, it was him." She said, "Did you know that young man, when he was very young, he had an accident. He fell on his head and he cracked his head. He's got brain damage. The poor young man will never go to school. He will never find a wife or get a job. He's got brain damage. He hit his head. You know, sometimes he does that to me. Sometimes he does that to someone else. He probably recognized that you hadn't been there before, so it's a new person to scold. But he's crazy. He's mad. He hit his head." And when the husband heard that, all his anger disappeared. How can you get upset and angry at the antics or speech of a crazy person? And actually he felt some compassion for that man who'd hit his head and could never find a wife or a partner or live a normal life. Because brain damaged people. It's just so sad. So his wife saw he'd cooled down and said, "Darling, I still need those eggs." So, "Okay, I'll go to the market again. And don't mind that young man." He said, "Okay, now I understand he's crazy. He's hit his head. It doesn't matter." So he took the basket and the money, went straight back to the market. The young man saw him again. "Hey, here comes dog poo. Close your eyes, this guy is so ugly, like the back of a camel." But this time it didn't matter, because the husband knew this guy was crazy. He went right to the egg store and the lady said, "Don't mind him, he's crazy." "Yeah, I just heard he hit his head." "Yeah, the poor boy, never get a wife, never get any life at all. He just hangs around the market. We let him abuse us. That's the least we can do for someone who's brain damaged." So the young man abused them all the way in the market, all the way out of the market. This time the husband didn't matter, because it was a crazy person. Now the moral of that story is this. If your husband comes home from work and scolds you and gets angry at you and calls you all sorts of names, just assume he must have hit his head somewhere that day and he's temporarily insane. If your wife argues at you, she must have hit her head while she was doing the cooking. Because it's true. Anyone who shouts, abuses, gets angry at someone else, in Buddhism we call that temporary insanity. No smart, wise person gets angry and scolds others or says those things to the people they love. So remember that. If your partner starts to get angry and scold you, they must have hit their head. They're temporarily insane. So wait for them to get their act together again. So that's one way how we can reduce anger in the world and also anger in our marriage. Next question. When meditating, is it always easy to get a headache when concentrating on the breath? How to solve this problem? Okay. Now I want you to look at me, especially the yogis in the front seat. Many people, when they watch their breath, actually, may I take my glasses off, it might be easy to see. Many people, when they're focusing on the breath, sometimes focus on the tip of the nose. And even though they've got their eyes closed, sometimes psychologically you don't realize your eyes are closed. And when you're looking at the tip of your nose, that's what you're doing. You're going cross-eyed. And for those of you who watch the breath at the tip of the nose, if I could peel your eyelids open, that's what you'd be doing. If you do that for half an hour, no wonder you get a headache. And that's actually true. Because those of you who try and watch the tip of the nose, actually, check your eyes. That's usually what you're up to. And that's where you usually get headaches across here. So don't watch the breath at the tip of the nose. Wherever your breath happens to manifest, that's where you watch it. The mistake is, for those of you who are interested, is the mistranslation of the Pali word purakata. When they say that you establish mindfulness purakata, people think that means in front of you. That's one possible translation of that word. But in front of, it's much closer to the English word, give it priority. Because when you make something prior, that means before, in front. But in English, the word priority means you make it important. So when it says, you start by making mindfulness important, this is the main thing you're doing at the beginning. Establishing that mindfulness above all other things. You make it first. You don't establish mindfulness in front of you. Most people think, in front of you means here. It means make it important, that's all. You don't just watch your breath here, because sometimes it's not here, it's somewhere else. In just the same way, today I'm sure being like Christmas Day in Australia, many people would have gone to my monastery in Australia looking for Ajahn Brahm. I'm usually there, that's where my monastery is. But they would not have found me. Why? Because I'm in Penang. In the same way, sometimes your breath is here, but sometimes you can't find it here. You know why? Because it's somewhere else. So you look for your breath wherever it happens to be. And that's actually much more relaxing and far more effective, and closer to the Buddha's teachings. Ajahn, can an 8th precept or a 10th precept or even a monk or nun touch animals of the opposite gender? Can they touch human babies of opposite gender too? Just curious, sadhu, three times. It's according to the rules of Vinaya, the original rules, yes, you can touch something of the other gender as long as it's not with lust. This is actually even though the commentaries say otherwise, even a female animal, no problem at all. But when it comes to like female babies, then you know already that in some religions there's many, many accusations of abuse, sexual abuse. And so sometimes these days in some countries like United States or even Australia, a teacher, like at school, can't touch one of the girl students because it's far too dangerous. No one knows. How can you know why that teacher touched that student? And because of the problem with accusations of abuse, it's very important that the monks of our modern day actually recognize it's much better to, no need to touch the opposite gender, no need for the nuns to touch the men. Animals is no problem at all. But if you touch a little baby, sometimes it can be an accusation if it's like a young female baby. Which is why that, you know, that personally I can see the point to having no contact with the opposite gender. Physical contact. So if anyone sort of wants to hug me, I run. However, I will confess to you a story, because sometimes living in Australia, it's a very interesting country. Once a lady kissed me. And I'll tell you what happened. It's a funny story. It was completely unintentional. I didn't want this to happen. But this is actually what happened. It was our neighbour. Our monastery is in farming country, so our neighbour has a farm. And he was an old man. He lost his wife. And we used to go for tea to meet with him. He was a very spiritual man, so was his wife. So they became great friends, and they were neighbours after all. We had to look after our neighbours. Even though he was a Christian, we were very friendly. And so his wife died, first of all, and then when he died a few months later, and I'd really looked after him in those last days of his life. So, you know, I was one of the people invited for the funeral service. And his daughter was the one arranging most of the funeral. And so at the end of the funeral, it's always a custom to say, you know, hope everything's okay, and I'll see you later. And usually in Australian funerals, she would hug all the well-wishers. And when it came to me, I stood back, because I knew what she was up to. And she came to hug me and give me a kiss. It was, no, just thank you very much, it's just what they do. And straight away I said, no, you're not allowed to do that. I'm a monk. Now this was a farmer's daughter. She was used to catching sheep and wrestling them to the ground. I had no chance. As soon as I said, you're not allowed to do that, she said, yes, I am. And I wasn't quick enough. I lost that one. So I freely admit that I sort of lost that one. But there was no intention, so no rules are broken there. She was just too quick for me. A farmer's daughter used to catching sheep. That's the only time that happened. Great fun in the West. Can an 8th precept... Oh yeah, I've done that one already. Next question here. Is it possible to seek help from devas and nagas to help in the progress of our meditation? Right, nagas are dragons. And devas are heavenly beings. Do such beings exist? Have you ever seen a deva? Or a dragon, a naga? Do you want to hear a deva story? Of course you do. I've got a couple of deva stories, but this is by far the best of them. And some of you may have actually heard this one before, because this is a very famous one. It happened in Thailand some years ago. An American young man had joined the Peace Corps, had done 2 years in Thailand doing projects up country. And having done those projects, he got interested in Buddhism, because Buddhism is so strong in Thailand and affects many parts of people's lives. So after finishing his Peace Corps work, he thought he'd become a monk. Because in Thailand, he'd become a monk for a short time, if you like. If you don't like, he could always leave. And it was a good time in his life, because you know, he finished the Peace Corps before he went home to America. Let's give being a monk a chance, see what it's like. So he was staying at a cheap hotel in Bangkok. And how do you become a monk? So, like many people staying in a hotel, he asked the concierge, you know, look, I'm really interested in Buddhism. I want to become a monk. Any idea how you become a monk? And the concierge, because he'd been around, he said, there is one monastery in Bangkok where they often have Westerners becoming monks. It's called Wat Bawon. And it's actually the abbot is still the Sangharaja of Thailand. In that time, I think he was just the abbot of that monastery. So quite a few years ago. So he said, Wat Bawon is the place for you. And what you should do is take some food, go early in the morning, and you'll see the monks come out on arms round. Put some food in one of the monks' bowls and ask them, can I be a monk? He knew a little bit of Thai, because he'd been there for a while. And so he thought, a great idea. So he got up really early in the morning, got some food, took a taxi, and the taxi dropped him outside Wat Bawon. But he got the time badly wrong. It was very early in the morning. No one was around, and the place was all locked up. So he walked up and down for a few minutes, wondering what to do. When a Thai man, came up to him and asked him, what are you doing this time of the morning outside this temple? And he said, look, I want to become a monk. And I got some food. The concierge at this hotel said, this is what I'm supposed to do, but it's all locked up. And the man said, yeah, of course it is. The monks aren't going to come out for a couple of hours. But look, never mind, said the man. I've got the keys. I'll take you inside. So the man opened the gate and took this young American inside. And he opened the door of the main temple in Wat Bawon. Now this is the king's temple. When the king of Thailand became a monk, that was where he was ordained. When the crown prince took temporary ordination, that main building was where he was ordained. So it's a royal temple where kings become ordained. So he took him inside, turned on the lights, and then he gave him a tour around the temple. Because on these Thai temples, they have all these murals on the walls. And even I sometimes look at those murals and try to figure out what they mean. Because there are stories from the Jatakas and other stories from the Dhammapada commentaries. And sometimes there are stories from Thai history. But this man, this guide, was so informative about all these paintings on the wall. And not just what they represented, he even knew about their history. Who painted them and why? Because somebody's father died and they decided to make merit and make this mural and share the karma with their dead father. He was such a source of great information about the paintings in the Upasita Hall, the ordination hall of Wat Bawon. And the time flew past until the man had completed his tour around the temple. He said, look, the monks will be coming out in 5 minutes. You stand over there, go out the gate, stand over there, the monks will come out, you put arms around, it will be a monk coming out sort of a little bit later, he's one of the senior monks, he's the one to put food in and say that I want to be a monk. So he went to stand and wait for this monk while the Thai man turned off the lights and locked the gates. And sure enough, 5 minutes later, this monk came out, he put food in the bowl, asked to become a monk. Yeah, you wait here, when I come back from arms round, I'll take you inside and start you on the process of becoming a monk. So he did that. I mean, you have to learn a lot of things to become a monk. Chanting, how to wear your robes, what to say at the ceremony, and the basic rules of Vinaya, the precepts for a monk. But this American got a bit frustrated because the man chosen to teach him was not very good at English. And so one day he sort of complained. He said, look, Khan, isn't there another monk in this monastery who speaks better English to explain these things to me? And they said, actually, this is the best guy we have. And the American said, what about that temple attendant I saw on the first day? The one who let me in the door and told me where to stand. And the monk said, what temple attendant? You know, the guy who had the keys for this gate. Keys for that gate? I know that gate myself because I was in China for 9 years. That is the royal gate. Only members of the Thai royal family are allowed to go through that gate. No layman has got the key. Nor have they got the key to that temple. They can't even turn the lights on in that place. The monks took him immediately to the abbot, Somdet Nyana Sangwara. He's now the Sangharaja of Thailand, although very, very old and sick. And he started recounting his story, and the abbot stopped him. Called for his secretary, start again. He wanted to write this down, because there is no layperson with those keys. You can't go through that royal gate. It's only open when the king or the crown prince comes to visit. For those of you who know, it's right opposite Mahamakut bookshop. And only the monks have the keys for the apostle hall. And you can't turn on the lights where he turned on the lights. Not even the abbot of this monastery knew all the history of those paintings. It was so long ago, over 120, 50 years ago or something. And so he wrote everything down. This was a man who didn't exist. Keys which no one had. Information which not even the abbot knew. And when finishing the account, they asked, what did that guy look like who opened up the gates for you? And he described him wearing old-fashioned Thai dress. Not the dress you wear these days, but the dress you may have seen in old paintings of 100 years ago. But what did his face look like? Now it's so hard to describe someone's face. So he was trying to figure out, he got a nose, two eyes. He was trying to figure out what to say and he was looking around. It was him. He saw the picture on the wall. That was the guy. The reason I had the picture on the wall in the office of the abbot of Wat Bawan, because that was one of the people who sponsored that building, King Mongkut, who died over 100 years ago. That is a true story recorded in the history of that monastery. Chet, I remember telling that story to the Thai ambassador of Singapore some years ago. He said, yeah, I know that story too. It's gone around. An American monk, or would-be monk, was assisted by an old king of Thailand who died many years ago. A deva, a heavenly being, just like you see in the old stories, had seen a young man with the aspiration to do something good. Shut outside of the monastery early in the morning, he decided to give him a hand to help him on those first steps to become a monk. That's what devas do. They will help you if there's any difficulty with you becoming a monk or a nun, but they will not help you if you want to go to the casino. That's a great story of devas, a true one. And these are not sort of beings who, like, you know, wear wings or, you know, just a wispy sort of things you see in your meditation or dream about when you're half asleep. This was waking life, fully alert, fully awake, and there was no difference, it seemed, between that person and an ordinary human being, except their clothing and just what they could do. So sometimes, as I say, ghosts can often appear to be just like ordinary human beings, the same as devas. In fact, there may be one sitting right next to you now. Okay, that's a Deva story. Okay, better go through questions quick. If we can concentrate well watching TV and studying for exams, should we be able to concentrate well on the breath as well? Anyhow, I don't find it quite true. No, because that you have incentive to watch the movie. If you want to find out, you know, what happens in the end. You have incentive to watch the football because you want to find out who's going to win. You have incentive to do the examinations. You've got to give yourself incentive to watch the breath. And if you give yourself some incentive, it's important to you to learn meditation, then you will do it. Which is why, like, people with cancer usually do very well in meditation simply because they're desperate. So if you thought maybe you have cancer, then maybe you could meditate well. There was one old monastery in Laos before the fall of Laos to the communists, and you know, I knew a monk who had practiced in this monastery, and he told me that the abbot would take the new monks for a walk in the jungle all day, a really tiring expedition, and he would arrange it to come to a clearing in the jungle, not that far from the monastery, just before twilight. Because in that clearing were these huge tall trees, and on a high branch of that tree they'd built a small platform about the size of those little blue mats which you're sitting on, with no railings on the edges, but with a ladder going from the ground up to the top. And the abbot would order the young monks to climb up that ladder, sit on that platform, then he'd take the ladder away and say, I'll be back in the morning. So these monks were sitting meditation, I don't know how many, 50, 60 feet above the ground, on a tiny mat, not wide enough to lay down, they could only sit cross-legged, and they knew if they fell asleep or started nodding, that would be it. I never heard of any monks who died, perhaps they covered that up. But they certainly, many monks got into deep meditation. Why? Because they had to. Otherwise it was death. So because of that, there was a lot of incentive to meditate. So this is actually, when you learn about meditation, and you can train on the breath, it's very easy to do your exams. But if you've got to train on something like the breath first of all, then you know the ins and outs of concentration. Next question, when can I transfer samatha to vipassana? What is the qualification? This is the old question of the difference between samatha meditation and vipassana meditation. And I mentioned this, I think, at the beginning. One day, Mr. Samatha and Mrs. Vipassana decided to go for a walk. Mr. Samatha, he said, I want to go up on top of the hill because it's so peaceful and calm up there. Mrs. Vipassana said, that's a good idea because I want to go up for the view. And I like sort of scenic views. So the two of them went up together up the hill. Mr. Samatha went up there for the peace. Mrs. Vipassana went up there for the view. But they went up the same hill together. Because when they got to the top, Mr. Samatha, oh, he enjoyed the peace. It was so calm up there. But he also enjoyed the view. And Mrs. Vipassana, when she reached the top, oh, she looked at the gorgeous, beautiful view. But she also enjoyed the peace. The reason is peace and the view coexist on the top of a mountain. And what that simile means is if you're practicing samatha or calm, you will at the same time be practicing vipassana or insight. If you're practicing insight, you'll also be practicing calm. Ajahn Chah many times says the same as the front of a hand and the back of the hand. Now you can all see the back of the hand, but I assure you the front is just on the other side. There it is. Now you can't see the back, but the back is there. You can't have the front of a hand without a back of a hand. He said, that's just like insight and calm. You may be looking at insight, but calm is right behind. You may be thinking you're practicing calm, but insight is right behind. The two of them always go together according to Ajahn Chah. And for those of you who still don't believe this, usually most people who practice insight sometimes call it satipatthana practice. And people who practice calm call it usually anapana, mindfulness on the breath. And I don't know how many of you have read these things for yourself, but if you look in the Anapanasati Sutra of the Buddha, you will see not only in the Anapanasati Sutra of the Majjhima Nikaya, but also in the Anapanasati Sangyutta, two places, the Buddha says, anybody who practices Anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath, according to the Buddha's way, also fulfills the four satipatthanas. So there the Buddha is saying, if you do Anapanasati, just mindfulness of the breath, you are also fulfilling the satipatthana practice. If you don't believe me, I can go to the library tomorrow, get the book out and show you. It's there, black and white. So there's no difference there. So you don't turn from one practice to another. You just carry on practicing. That's why that, you know, that sometimes Anapanasati means mindfulness of the breath. Some of you who sit too long and get aches and pains, it's not called Anapanasati, it's called Anapanasati. Mindfulness along with pain. And that's not what the Buddha taught. So do not do Anapanasati, Anapanasati. And mindfulness, if you can't do Anapanasati, then I'll teach you mindfulness of the breath instead. If you can't think, isn't that the same? Of course it is. If you can't do mindfulness of the breath, I'll teach you metta meditation. If you can't do metta meditation, I'll teach you loving kindness. These are all the same. It's all ways of quieting the mind, becoming more mindful, more peaceful, more alert, more still. But we just approach it from different angles, that's all. As a Buddhist, what should we do when out of a sudden our friends are being possessed by evil spirits? Or when we ourselves face this issue? You've got to be very careful these days. I said this last time I was in Penang, especially this time of the year, probably even tonight, you'll find many people possessed by evil spirits. I said that the worst of these is a very, very dangerous ghost. This ghost is prevalent in our modern age throughout the world. I've seen this ghost. This is not fantasy. I've seen this ghost possess people. And it makes them do strange things. Their faces contorted. And they don't speak like they normally do. They don't. They speak in a very, very strange way. And they do weird, dangerous things. Isn't this what a possession is? They're not like their normal selves. They speak in a weird way, do strange things. It's called a bottle ghost. It's a very, very dangerous ghost, the bottle ghost. The bottle ghost lives in bottles of whiskey and beer and wine. When you take out the top and start drinking it, you get possessed by the bottle ghost. And it makes you say strange things and speak in a weird way and do. You can't even walk straight when you're possessed by the bottle ghost. You understand what I mean? Yeah, you're drunk. And it's supposed to be Christmas holiday time now, soon New Year. There'll be many people in Penang outside there who are completely possessed by the bottle ghost. Isn't that why we call whiskey spirits? So that's what I mean by being possessed by a spirit. In my whole life, I've only ever seen one person who I reckon was possessed by a spirit. Very, 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 very rare. So you have got hardly anything to worry about. There's much more chance of being struck by lightning than being actually worried about being possessed by a spirit. And especially those of you who keep five precepts, you have got nothing to worry about. You are invulnerable. How to know I am in the first jhana? If you can ask that question, am I in the first jhana, then you are not. If you want more information, you can read my book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, in the back. Will meditation help ease injury sustained during accident? Will it help in controlling anger? If yes, is it done the same way? Forgive me for always falling asleep when attempting to meditate. I will try harder. Please don't try harder. Don't try at all. Be at peace. Stop all this trying business. That's why you're falling asleep. Because you've tried so much in the past, you are tired. Make peace, not war. You know, I used to be a child of the 60s. You know, I used to go around with your two fingers up. Make peace, not war. Make peace, not war. I haven't changed, but it's a different type of peace. Make peace in your heart. Don't make war with yourselves. Don't make war with your sloth and torpor. Otherwise, it will continue. Make peace with it. Just be at peace with it. Enjoy it for a little while longer, and then it will disappear. And then you'll have peace left. And it does ease injury, because once you get still and peaceful, you get a natural healing in the body. Actually, I did promise many people that I would talk about this. It's happened many, many, many times when I've been teaching retreats that in interviews people have come along and said they've got a lot of heat or jerking in their body, or sometimes their body contorts and they're meditating in a very strange way. At first I didn't really understand what was going on, but now I understand perfectly what's going on. For example, some years ago, a lady came to me. She said when she was meditating, she got quite peaceful, had all this heat in her back and neck. It got really hot. So I said to her, when did you have your back injury? And she started laughing and said, Ajahn Brahm, you've done psychic powers. You know I had a back injury. I said, no, I didn't do psychic powers. It's just logic. Because I know that the reason you got all that heat in your back was because that's where some injury was. And when you get very still and peaceful, all the energy in your body has a chance to go to where it's needed. And that's why it's all gone to your back, and I can guarantee you felt so much better afterwards. So yeah, I felt just so at ease, things were loose. The guy who went into contortion while he was meditating, he didn't force this, it just happened to him. And the reason was he had an accident. And that was how the body felt it needed to open the channel so the energy could flow to that area. Other people have jerks in their body, and all that is again energy being going through the blockage so it can actually flow to the parts needed. Some women have heat in their breast because they've either had breast cancer or it's incipient cancer, and when they get very still, the energy goes in there and heals things. Because all of the time, your body is an amazing device. And it has all of the healing mechanisms in it, not just the immune system, but the flow of energies. The reason why we get sick is because we're so tense, we struggle and strive so much, that our body doesn't have a chance to heal itself. If you can really relax in meditation, it's amazing just how healing happens. Another, I don't mind telling you, it's my personal story. There's a small little thing which happened to me because I was in Canberra giving some talks a few years ago. For those of you who know the town of Canberra, it's one of the coldest cities in Australia. So I was there for a few days. After a couple of days, I caught a terrible cold. And when you've got a cold, you know, your eyes are dripping, your nose is dripping, you keep on sneezing, you keep on coughing. And my host decided that morning to take me on to another monastery a long way out of Canberra. We were there all day. I felt terrible. I wanted to get back, have a rest, at least have a shower. But the monks in that monastery kept me there. They wouldn't let me go. They had all these ceremonies. I was very upset. Because by the time I got to the venue where the talk was to be held, I had 10 minutes before the talk started. And I felt terrible. Not only did I have a cold, but I was exhausted from traveling all day. But, you know, nevertheless, all these people had come to listen to me, so I tried my best to give a talk. It was one of the worst talks I could ever give. Because you tried to get to start, and then you'd sneeze, and then you'd cough. And you could never actually keep a train of thought because your eyes and your nose was dribbling into the microphone. It was disgusting. But I tried, and after about 25 minutes, I said, look, this is silly. Let's do some meditation for half an hour. So we all meditated for half an hour. They had to. And after half an hour, I gave my talk. Without a cough, without a sneeze, nothing dribbling. And people afterwards said, they weren't listening to the talk. They were waiting for the cough or the sneeze, which never came. They thought, wow, it's amazing. Because they saw me with a cold, and in half an hour there was no cold. It's amazing what you can do with meditation, because I really had to, because there's too many people who have come to listen to the talk. This is what you can do.
May I know while mind is still and breath is subtle, can I switch to contemplate 32 parts of organs or continue to watch the breath? Started.
Now don't go switching here and switching there. Just stay with what you're doing. If it's peaceful, don't spoil it. So sometimes people want to contemplate all sorts of things. You should contemplate peace. Contemplate stillness. Enjoy the peace while it's there in meditation. Don't make it complicated. Dear Ajahn, I am a Buddhist, do a lot of Dharana to Sangha, read a lot of Dharma books and Sutta study, listening to teachings, even attend retreat, but I could not control my emotion. Sometimes aversion and anger arises. I shout to others. I know this may hurt others' feelings and create bad karma, but I could not manage to control my emotion. May I know how and what I should do to improve this aspect? Yeah, I know there's some people who practice Buddhism, and sometimes they practice so hard. That's why they get so angry, because they're not practicing properly. When you struggle, I'm going to control my breath. I'm going to control my emotions. I'm going to control my mind. I'm going to control. If you are a control freak, you don't know what Buddhism is. Do not be a control freak. If you are a control freak, that's where anger comes from. Where anger comes from, you try to control your mind, control your life, you will eventually come across some obstacle which you can't control, usually your wife or your kids, or your husband or something, your business. And people who succeed in controlling in their early life, they're the troublemakers. The successful people think that because they can have succeeded so far, all they need to do is to exert their will and they can get whatever they want, or they can overcome the obstacles in life. But eventually, when you follow the path of will, you'll soon come to something which you can't beat. And that's where you get frustrated. Frustration leads to anger, and anger leads to this emotional outburst. All coming from frustration, coming from misplaced confidence in your will. In meditation, in Buddhism, you should learn how to let go more. More loving kindness, more gentleness. Right thought, number two of the Eightfold Path, means thoughts or intentions of letting go, loving kindness and gentleness. Nekama Sankapa, Awayapada Sankapa, Ahingsaka Sankapa. Here translated quite accurately as thoughts of letting go, thoughts or intentions of loving kindness, the door of my heart's open to this moment, to you, whatever. And thoughts of gentleness, not violence. If you do violence to your body, violence to your mind, no wonder you get angry. So the reason is people sometimes they don't understand what Buddhism is. Don't be violent, be gentle. Gentle when you study, gentle when you discuss, gentle when you meditate, and then you'll be gentle when you go home afterwards.
For 20 minutes of sitting, my mind was mindful and peaceful. Later, a lot of hindrances attacked my mind. Sadhu, we had 20 minutes. Be grateful for that. So wonderful. You had 20 minutes of peace. Good on you. So stop being so demanding in nature. The Christians have their way of funeral, and so as the Muslims and Taoists or Hindus. How about the Buddhists? How should a Buddhist funeral be conducted? Without superstition and without too many tears. In a Buddhist funeral, we celebrate the life. We don't mourn the death. For example, this was a great Buddhist funeral recently. There was a lady in Australia, in Perth, who liked to play the game of bingo. Do you know bingo? For those who don't, they have a card with a series of about 15 numbers, and people draw these little balls, like a lottery, and when the ball comes out, it has a number, and if it's the number, one of the numbers on your card, you tick it off. And the person who gets all the 15 numbers ticked off, they shout out, bingo, and they win a prize. It's like a little bit of harmless gambling, but it's not real gambling. You don't do it for lots and lots of money. It's more like for fun. And so the lady who died loved to play bingo. That was one of her hobbies. So you know what they did at the funeral? The people arranging the funeral handed out bingo cards to everybody who came to the funeral. And the funeral director had a bingo thing where he called out the numbers, and this was out of memory, because this is what the lady loved to do, to play bingo. But the nice thing was that nobody realized that they all had the same numbers on their cards. So when the last number was called, everybody shouted out in unison, bingo! Everyone was a winner. And it was just a nice way of actually celebrating a person's life rather than mourning a death. So a Buddhist funeral is for the people left behind so they can celebrate a life and actually make a sort of a closure of what happened and move on to do something else. And for the person who's died, actually to make sure that they also move on. So Buddhist funerals are very, very popular, and so popular that many Christians in Perth, and this is not exaggeration, have asked me, can I do their funeral for them, because they were very impressed the way the Buddhists do funerals. So I'm already booked up to do funerals for Christians. What is the difference of Nibbana and the world of Amitabha? Pure Land, if greed is very strong, if you want more money or gamble, how to stop it? There's a huge difference. Nibbana is the end of things. The idea of the Pure Land is said to be like a stage on the path, but Nibbana is the end. But I won't go into too much detail on there, but if greed is very strong, we want more money, how to stop it? A very easy way. Use wisdom. Recent research which has come out of the United States, they wanted to see the connection between wealth and happiness. And one of the things which I think we all know, if you have too much money, and these multimillionaires, sometimes they're so lonely, they've got so many worries because they've got so much responsibility. They're afraid of their relations, because every time they see like a cousin, they're always asking for some money. They're afraid of religions, because we always ask them for donations. So wealthy people are very lonely. If it's a wealthy person, they wouldn't dare come in this hall, because they see a donation box and run. So it's well known that too much money is actually bad for your happiness, but also too little money is bad for your happiness, because being poor, being hungry, having no place to stay is a big worry. So it's obvious there must be some sort of peak income, peak amount of money, which gives you the maximum happiness. And this is what a number of universities in the United States did huge amounts of research to find the optimum income, the income where you're the peak of happiness. And what they found in the United States was $50,000 US a year. Less than that, and you were generally unhappy. But more than that, you had just too many problems. And your simplicity, your friendship, sort of started to suffer. So 50,000 was the peak. Now, the way to solve your greed, and also as an act of compassion from me, if there's anyone in this room earning more than 50,000 a year, we can help you. Donation box over there, we can lessen your problem for you. Out of compassion for you. So that's only a joke. I said that in Perth when I first read the research. It didn't work at all.
But nevertheless, it's a nice thing to know, and I think you can understand there's a truth to that. Too much money, too many possessions, and you're not happy anymore. There is a middle way. So you find that middle way, and that means don't be too greedy. More money doesn't make you more happy. Understand that, and your greed is just average, and it is conducive to happiness, not conducive to too many heart attacks. So that's the talk this evening. All the questions, I've gone over time for a quarter of an hour, but let's do the sharing of merits, and then we can make the announcement. Sharing of merits first.
Itam men yatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Itam men yatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Itam men yatinang hotu sukhita hantu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Okay, and tomorrow night the talk is on the Buddhism and science, or
the Buddha and science.
The Buddha and science. So those of you who want to understand the relationship between science and religion, that's coming up tomorrow night. See you there.
Okay, brothers and sisters in the Dhamma, we have good news for you. Ajahn Brahm's latest book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, is now available. But unfortunately, we have very limited copies. Now, this is the ultimate book on meditation from practitioners. But anyway, it starts with, it has the beginning for basis for instructions, right up to how to develop your mindfulness, and the jhanas, and beyond. Now, this book has been made available to us at a discount because of Ajahn Brahm. This book is a gem. It's priceless, but you can purchase it. It will be at 60 ringgit, but if you would wish to pay more for the book, you are most welcome. All the excess funds from the money from this book will be donated to the retreat center which is being built in Perth. The retreat center has now been given a name. It's called Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat. This retreat center will be built when the construction March, actually. Yes, the construction will start on March. The funds raised so far we are about two-thirds from what is needed. So if you would like to contribute to the center, or the construction of the cost of the center, there are donation boxes at the back. Now, this retreat center, when it's available, the facilities will be available for free if you wish to go there and practice. Good night. Merry Christmas.